this morning I'm going to give you a lesson, but it's kind of more for me than it is for anyone else. It's a subject that I've been wanting to study and really just never took the time to look into it. So it's really, I'm going to talk about this morning the Tower of Babel. So I'm going to give you a little history on it and talk a little bit about what it means. And the reason I kind of interested in the subject, it seems like with all my travels, everywhere I go, I've been, you know, there's different languages and there's different languages within the language. There's different dialects. And there's a bunch of information on language out there. So I'm going to go ahead and get started. And I don't know if you realize it or not, but everyone in this room is part of a minority group. Less than 10% of the people in the world speak English. Estimates are that just fewer than 500 million people on planet Earth are English speakers, while over twice that many speak Mandarin Chinese. There are many, many languages on the planet today. Approximately 6,900 languages are known to have existed, and today over 5,500 are still spoken. It is interesting that many linguists, people who study languages, have finally decided that the Bible has been right all along. They agree that there was initially only one human language. So how did we get from 1 to 6,900? That's the confusion with the linguists. Linguists have a variety of explanations. Matter of fact, there was over 50. But I'm convinced the best and true answer for the diversity of languages is found in Genesis 11, the story of the Tower of Babel. This is our text today. This is found in Genesis 11, 1 through 9. What is the meaning of Babel? So I looked up, you know, what is the meaning of Babel? Well, if you can think in this congregation that everyone around spoke a different language, what would we have here? Confusion. We wouldn't be able to understand anything at all, and we wouldn't be able to be a group and learn from each other. We'd have no way to learn. So let's look at the story of Babel. The events recorded in Genesis 11 occurred between the time of Noah and Abraham. It is impossible to get precise dates from the Genesis genealogies, but Babel may be thousands of years after Noah. Genesis 11:2, as men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. Trouble is around the corner. Horace Greeley, grandfather, once told him, "Head west, young man, head west." That is almost biblical because in Genesis, anyway, whenever someone heads east, there is trouble. And I never knew this till I was studying about the Tower of Babel and I looked up everything that everybody moved east. And I'm not trying to say that we should never visit the east and we should never go east of where we live because we're going to be in trouble and we should always take vacations west, but it makes you wonder a little bit. When Adam and Eve expelled from the garden, they moved east of Eden. When Cain left the presence of the Lord, he went east to Nod. Chapter 13, Lot will settle east of Sodom. We know what happened to Lot. Here in Genesis 11, the people head east and up in the plain of Shinar, which is in modern Iraq. We are not going to get into speculation about biblical prophecy today, but it's worth noting that Babel and Babylon, the focal points of the opposition of God, both in the Old Testament and the Book of Revelations, are located in Iraq. Today, ISIS is in Iraq and wants to rule the world. So let's read Genesis 11, 1 through 9. And the whole earth had one language and of one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said one to another, "Go to, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone, and slime had they for mortar. And they said, "Go to, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top may reach into heaven. And let us make a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth." And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, "Behold, the people is one, and they have all one language, and this they begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them, which they have imagined to do. Go to, let us go down, and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech, So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did there confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon all the face of the earth. When people think about the biblical account of the Tower of Babel, they usually associate as the Bible's explanation of diverse languages. Confusing their language is a part of this story. It's a very small part. I thought it would be a big part. I thought that's what I was studying. But it's not the main focus of this account at all. The main focus of this story has nothing to do with languages. The language issue is only one of the details in this story. This is an account of the generations after Noah rejecting the commands of God. There are four key areas I see in this passage that this study will examine. First of all, the first subject to this is they want to preserve their group. They want to preserve their clan. They want to preserve their relationships. They want to preserve their race. They want to be around each other. The flood ended with this command in Genesis 9, 1 and 2. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, upon every fowl of the air, upon all that moveth upon the earth, and upon all the fishes of the sea. Into your hand are they delivered." Yet this generation said, "Let's build a city and tower." And in verse 4, "Lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." The entire foundation of their plan was in violation of God's commands. Since the fall, man has been seeking to build a utopia. The longing in our hearts is for what we have lost. The quest for heaven on earth has not ended and will not end until Christ returns. God's purpose for man has always been to go out and to do His will. We can only be complete in Him, and we can only be satisfied in the center of His will. He is the one who satisfies, not things or activities. Even the church gets sidetracked from the purpose of God by seeking to live in a self-contained world. There is this idea that it would be nice to isolate from the world and only have church people and church functions at the center of our social life. The focus is on self and not God's purpose for our lives. There is a line that must be drawn between living in the world and living for the world. We should cut off the contacts that are destructive to our faith, but not isolate the church into a separate culture. We are the salt of the world and the light of the world. We are not salt for ourselves and light to the enlightened. In the early church, God used persecution to get the church out of its isolated state and to the culture where their light could shine and impact the world. God used Saul. And if we think about the story of Saul, we'll understand how God used Saul. God used Saul to scatter the church and then later called him to preach the gospel throughout the known world. He began as a persecutor, and then God transformed him into a new creation and changed his name to Paul the Apostle. God used him on both sides, and we find this in Acts 3 and 4. As for Saul, he made havoc of the church, entering to every house and hauling men and women committed to prison. Therefore, they that were scattered abroad went everywhere preaching the word. God doesn't bless us so that we can lavish in His blessings. God blesses us so that we can bless those around us. He equips us so we can go out and do His will and touch the lives of others in His name. By nature, we are self-centered. When the church gets a self-centered worldview, they lose sight of God's plan. When we become self-centered, we want to be isolated from anything that will interfere with our world. Fearing to lose that we have is why people resist outreach. That's why they wanted to protect themselves. Out of a self-centered view of life, the people of Babel made the decision to build their own utopia. They were going to build their own world. Their goal was security and preservation. The life was all they acknowledged. God did not call man to protect his life and lifestyle at all cost, but to live his life with an eternal perspective. If we live like this is all there is, this is all we will have. We find in Proverbs 11, 24 and 25 about how we should live our life There is one who scatters, yet increases more, and there is one who withholds more than is right, but it leads to poverty. The generous soul will be made rich, and he who waters will also be watered himself. If we want a blessed life, God requires that we get outside of ourselves. If we strive to preserve what is ours, we will see it slip away. But if we reach out as God commands us to do, God will increase abundantly above anything we have scattered. We are to give. We are all rich. You may not think you're rich, but everyone in this room is rich. Compared to the people of this world, there is no one in this audience that is not rich. And we all have the ability to give, whether it's of ourselves, whether it's of our time, whether it's of our money, whether it's teaching someone something that you've learned, keeping them from following mistakes that you've already done. You have the ability to give back, and you should always do that. The second point in the Tower of Babel is the works of our hands. And as I read through this, I want you to think about something as I read through this. Is there anything at all that you can make with your hands that God cares about? I want you to think about that. Think about the things that God has made with His hands and what you make with yours. I always used to, being an engineer, I like to build things, and you like to see what you build and you like to see what you do. And there's a lot of people in here that have a product that they make. And you're proud of that product, and you did your best, and you put all your hours and your time and your sweat and everything in it. But it's something that you're proud of. And I think we should all do our best, and we should all be proud of everything we do. But is that something that you've done for God? Because would God want that? And I came to terms when I was studying this lesson that there isn't anything that we can make with our hands that God would need or want. What He wants us to do is what we're doing here this morning. This is what the will of God is, that we come here and that we get together and we do His commandments and we remember His Son. And that's what He wants. So really what we did this morning is the will of God. The first point that I made was we should go out and spread that will. I mean, the other thing that He really wants from us to do with our hands and do with our feet and do with our mouth is go out and spread the gospel, whether it's pamphlets, brochures, our website, Facebook, tweets. You know, there's so many ways anymore that God has given us to spread His word. That's what He wants from us. So the next thing that the Tower of Babel, that the people did that was completely wrong, is the works of their hands. Works of our hands was the second topic. And this is found again in verse 4. Verse 4 has most of the bad things that they were trying to do. And it says in verse 4, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens." So they wanted to get as close to God as they could get. God does not honor the works of our hands. God honors those who yield themselves to His will and allow God to produce good works through us. To work without obedience is our own efforts, but through obedience, God produces good works through us. Let's look at Deuteronomy 30, 8 and 9. "And you will again obey the voice of the Lord and do all His commandments, which I command you today. The Lord your God will make you abound in all the work of your hand, in the fruit of your body, in the increase of your livestock, and in the produce of your land for good. For the Lord will again rejoice over you for good, as He rejoiced over your fathers." So He tells them exactly what He wants there. If the builders of Babel had labored to obey, then they would have had the right motives, and God would have led them to the work He was doing and blessed the works of their hands. If Babel was part of God's plan, He would have blessed them. If not, He would have led them to work that He could have blessed. Back in those days, God talked to them. The first key in finding God's will and the work God is calling us is found in John 12. verses 24 through 26. Most assuredly, I say unto you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it produces much grain. He who loves his life will lose it, and he who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, let him follow me, and where I am, where my servant will be also. If anyone serves me, him my Father will honor. Until a person sees the bigger picture of God's plan, they will cling to their own life and seek their own works. The one who responds to God's plan will follow Jesus' call. When we die to ourselves for the sake of submitting to God, we will produce a fruitful and fulfilled life. Alone, we are like the grain of wheat that can do nothing. When we die in Christ, we are made alive. It is impossible to follow Christ without choosing to die to myself. When I die to myself, I live and abide in Christ, and He produces the fruit in my life. God blesses what He produces, not what I produce. It is God that gives me significance and belonging. God's works are produced when we yield ourselves to God. I don't ask God to bless what I am doing, but I pray and seek to find where God is leading, and I take up what God is blessing. God doesn't change, I do. In John 15, Jesus said in verse 4 and 5, abide in me and I in you, as the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abide in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, ye are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him bears much fruit, for without me you can do nothing. The key is abiding. God directs me to work and produce the fruit of that work. The people of Babel sought to reach the heavens by their own labor and were climbing the tower of their own works. And then the third point we find in this, it says, let us make a name for ourselves. So they wanted to be known. They wanted to do something that everybody would see and everybody would know. Only God can make a name great. We find this in Romans 13. This is in Romans 13, 1 and 2. Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whosoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. This is something we need to remember, especially this year. All authority comes from God and is appointed by God. We're here to vote. We're here as citizens of the United States of America. Our responsibility is to vote. And we don't get to decide who is on the ballot for us to vote for. We did a little bit as a nation. So we get to put parties and representatives in there for us to vote on. But our task is to vote and vote for the person that we feel like can run the country the best. But God's going to put whoever He wants to run this nation. It's going to be God that puts them in there. We are all a tool of God to go forward. We find in these verses, all authority comes from God and is appointed of God. Even those who are wicked and are in authority, God allowed them to be in authority. He allowed them to be in charge. God appoints evil men for judgment to accomplish His purpose, or so His name can be glorified. Those who seek to exalt themselves, God will humble. We find this in Matthew 23:11. In the account of Babel, we see that kingdoms banded together to build a tower with the ultimate goal of making their name great instead of acknowledging God. Let's jump ahead one chapter into Genesis 12. Now the Lord said unto Abram, get out of your country, for your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Abram, or Abraham, submitted himself to God. We can see that God made Abraham great. But what did Abraham do? Abraham humbled himself, and God exalted him by the people of, but the people of Babel exalted themselves, and God scattered their plans and divided the people. Abraham humbled himself, left his secure place at the command of the Lord, and God made Abraham's name great. God gave Abraham the very thing the people of Babel sought. Abraham received the promise of God because he died to himself and to his own plans and followed God. Abraham found the promise of Isaiah 57:15, which says, "For thus says the high and lofty one who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy, I dwell in the high and holy place with him who has a contrite and humble spirit, to revive the spirit of the humble and to revive the heart of the contrite ones." What a promise. God who inhabits eternity and dwells in the high and holy place also dwells with him who is humble and contrite. Those who seek to glorify their name can't seek to glorify God. And then the fourth thing that we find in here, and this was kind of a thing that opened my eyes, which I never thought would be in the Tower of Babel. And in verse 6, we find that nothing purposed will be restrained. You know, I probably read the Tower of Babel, I would say 100 times, because I always, you know, thought it was all about language. And in verse 6, when he says that, when God says that, he's actually showing them mercy. And when I read through some of these things, you'll, if you think about that, that he's doing them a favor by doing what he does. In verse 6 it says, "Now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do." History has shown the truth of God's warning in this passage. The only thing that restrains the evil of men's hearts is accountability. When a group thinks and acts as one outside of God's plan, the result is always tragic. There has never been a time when all of humanity has united in one mindset. God in his mercy has always restrained humanity by foiling their plans. We have had glimpses of what is possible through unity without God. Hitler was able to unite almost all the people in an entire nation with the same mind, and the result was the extermination of over 17 million people. Stalin was able to unite the political and military forces of Eastern Europe, and the result was a 50-year tyranny that murdered over 27 million people. The confusion of the language in this passage is an act of mercy. When God allows man to have the godless desires of his heart, it is never the utopia Satan promises, but chaos and tragedy. There is not one example of a godless society that is not turned against the people. The strong always oppress the weak. Selflessness, greed, and the desire create envy, murder, thieves, etc. The world united truly would fulfill the warning that God declares when he said, "Nothing will restrain them." At the heart of all the world religions, including atheism, is the belief that at the core of man is good. Man builds worldly systems around this belief, and because the foundation is a false belief, the perfect society always crumbles into a violent attempt to maintain control or power. And if you think about the countries that are nothing but war, it is strictly over power and control. Since the beginning, mankind has always tried and failed in attempts to establish his perfect society. God has reserved a time when this united society will occur, but it is at the end of time when Christ will come and he will take us up to that ultimate society, that utopia that we all dream about. If we lay aside what we want for the sake of pursuing God's will in him, we will find everything our heart desires. If God turns us over to our desires without restraint, our desires will always oppress us and eventually destroy us. But if we pursue Christ, we will not allow you to be unsatisfied. The problem is that most people don't want to trust in Christ. Psalms 36:7 through 9 says, "How precious is your loving kindness, O God! Therefore the children of men put their trust under the shadow of your wings. They are abundantly satisfied with the fullness of your house, and you give them drink from the river of your pleasures. For with you is the fountain of life, in your light we see light. Without faith, trusting under the shadow of his wings, we will never benefit from this promise." With that, I would like to ask anyone that wants to be part of this congregation or part of Christ Church, you now have the opportunity to come forward and make your wishes known, or to be baptized into Christ's body as we stand and sing the invitation song.